Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Come on over to the commonsprojectnetwork.com and check us and a lot of alternative media out.
Socialist Insight. And once again, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program as he joins us every other Monday. And he brings us a lot of insightful information on things that pertain to the left, things that we need to be aware of that we have choices that we can pursue as a, if we work together in dealing with many of the problems that exist in a capitalist society. And Alan, once again, I would like to welcome you to the Socialist Insight. Thanks again for joining the program.
Yep, thanks for having me, Stuart.
One of the things I was just mentioning before the program, Alan, you know, is over the past year and 2 months that the Socialist Insight has been on the air, where people can be able to listen to you and many of the other guests that have that appear and show up on the program. A lot of people are starting to take an interest in the program. You in particular, people mention you by name. They say they always enjoy listening to Alan Mackey. But I find that people are taking a sincere interest in what we're talking about because they had received so much negative information about what socialism is all about. And a lot of times people just don't really understand that socialism is the way for working people and capitalism is not the answer. And Alan, I believe, as I mentioned to you before the program, I believe this show is really making a difference with many people in our community, especially young people. What is your opinion on that?
I think we are, too. More and more people are telling me they're listening to the program in the archives and sharing it with other people. So I think that, you know, we probably don't know yet how far the program is getting circulated, but I think we got to keep pushing it, Stuart, because people don't get these views other places. Even if they don't agree completely, I think we're sparking some dialogue and discussion and debate.
Right, exactly. And Alan, today what we're talking about on the Socialist Insight, as we had mentioned in the topic that we had shared with many of our listeners, the question is, why are 23 million people unemployed in the U.S.? And that's some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Workers are needed for daycare, for senior care. Workers are needed to repair our streets and highways. Workers are needed to build affordable housing and shelter for the homeless. Workers are needed to build schools, and workers are needed to restore the nation's infrastructure. So, Alan, why are millions of Americans unemployed?
Well, millions of Americans are unemployed for the simple reason that capitalism is in a serious economic crisis. What happens is we're in a crisis of overproduction right now. Workers are not able to buy back what they produce because they're not being paid enough. And wages have been deteriorating steadily for, you know, over 30 years now in this country. We have a minimum wage that's $7.25 an hour. Some states it's even less. And for some industries, like the hospitality industries, they have an even lower minimum wage. So people who are poor like this, they cannot buy the products that are being produced, and you end up with a glut of what's been produced, and no more production is necessary. So you have all these people unemployed. Plus, we have this huge influence on what creates unemployment is these wars that are taking place. Because, I mean, common sense tells us as long as we've got these wars going all over the world and we've got this huge military-industrial complex and the militarism, the constant production of for the military-industrial complex, that we're not going to have the resources required to do the kinds of things that you were talking about, like taking care of our schools and building new schools, taking care of the bridges and highways and roads in this country. You know, but not only that, we don't have the resources to create a national public health care program like we need. We don't have the resources to create a national public child care program like we need. These are things
mm-hmm.
that were
right.
taken off the agenda during the New Deal, and we need to take up where the New Deal left off and put these things back on the agenda, and this is going to require peace dividends to pay for all this. If we can't get the peace dividends, then we're definitely going to have to tax the wealthy to the hilt and tax the corporations and their profits to pay for all this. And this isn't being done right now, and this is why so many people are unemployed. We need to put these people to work doing the things that, like you were talking about.
And Alan, when we talk about like single payer, one of the things about single payer, what it would do, it would have created one thing that many socialists are proponents of, would create millions and millions of jobs. But what we can see in Obamacare, the only thing is it keeps the infrastructure the same way it is, where it feeds into the healthcare industry for private profit. But the thing is, it really doesn't create millions of jobs, even that part of Obama's program. Is that correct?
Well, I agree. That is correct. In fact, what we see is the same thing that's happening with the war industry. With Obamacare, it's actually killing jobs, just like the war industries are killing jobs. And, you know, if we really want to create jobs, single-payer universal health care like they have in Canada would create about 3 or 4 million new jobs in this country. If we took that as a first step towards a national public health care system, then a national public health care system would actually create 12 to 15 million new jobs in this country, because we would have a health care system based on community and neighborhood health care centers. In other words, our health care would operate just like the public schools do. And this is what we really need. Single payer would be a step towards that if we implement it in that way. A lot of people talk about just single payer as the end, and I don't think that's the real solution. I've always promoted single payer as a step towards a national public health care system, and I think that's what we need to talk about, because
now
it creates
many
millions of jobs.
Well,
the
difference
is single payer.
Listeners can understand.
Single payer is based on public financing of healthcare, public administration of healthcare, but private delivery of healthcare. In other words, the doctors would remain under the private for-profit system. Under a national public healthcare system, we would have public delivery of healthcare in addition to public administration and public financing. It would work just like our public schools do, and our public schools work good. I don't think anybody would suggest that we would go do away with public schools and go over to a private for-profit education system. I mean, a couple people on the very far right would recommend that, but I think we all know poor people would end up not being able to read or write or do math if that happened. So our public schools work well, and our a national public health care system would work in the same way that our public schools do.
So you wouldn't have any private hospitals or private clinics, or everything would be done, would be publicly owned, just like the public schools, and the services would be delivered based on the way the schools are actually financed. Is that correct?
Correct. The doctors and the nurses and all the healthcare people would be paid just like public school teachers are. They would be on the public payroll. And I haven't heard any public school teachers complain about being on the public payroll, have you?
No, not yet.
So I think that, you know, Francis Perkins, who was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor, she actually had gotten a national public health care system. She called it socialized health care on the New Deal agenda, but the right wing in the Democratic Party attacked it so viciously they had to take it off. I don't think they really had to, but Roosevelt, he gave in to this very right-wing strain of the Democratic Party and removed it to avoid any confrontation with these people in return for them agreeing to implement the rest of the New Deal program. She also advocated that we should have a national public child care system, and she advocated that both the national public child care system and the national public health care system would be financed just like Social Security through an employee-employer payroll deduction. And I think most people would agree to that. In fact, it would cost less to pay into a national public health care system and a national public child care system than what it does to even pay into Social Security. That's, so it's, you know, it's a much cheaper way of financing health care and child care.
And, Alan, later on during the program here, we're going to get into the concept of a 21st Century Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity. And we're going to get into some of these numbers that we have, health care, 15 million jobs, child care, 5 million. But we're going to get into that. But what I want to backtrack just a second here. We had, during the time when he was running as a candidate for president, we had President Barack Obama sent with his jobs program. He was asking Congress to deliver him $1 trillion. And then it went down to $875 billion. But he got roughly $800 billion. And in addition to that, he got a carryover of $350 billion from the Bush administration. But we can see that that still was far short of what was needed. But the thing that was very disappointing, Obama said he had a jobs program within his first 6 months in office, he was going to be putting people to work with shovel-ready jobs. The shovel-ready jobs never even happened, Alan. It was just a shovel of something, but it wasn't for shovel-ready jobs. What do you have to say about this president and his performance delivering shovel-ready jobs, delivering jobs that can put working people to work in good-paying jobs?
Well, he delivered about 300,000 of those jobs at a cost of $850 billion, like you pointed out, under the American, Reinvestment Act.
If you look at the number of that, Alan, all those jobs that he created, I think the number worked out to be roughly almost $500,000. It was over $500,000 per job that was created.
Yeah, and the other thing is,
the numbers were ridiculous.
Yeah, and most of these jobs only lasted 2 to 6 months on highway construction and stuff. And affirmative action wasn't even enforced on any of these projects. Not one single one of these projects where the $800 billion was spent, affirmative action was not enforced. First time in history since Lyndon Johnson signed the affirmative action executive order. And, you know, Obama promised a lot of things. He promised jobs, and the Democrats have been promising jobs for, you know, since Harry Truman was in office. And we've never seen those jobs, because there's no way to force these people, these legislators, once they're elected, to force them to create the jobs and maintain full employment. And that was the purpose of the 1945 Full Employment Act, which was passed by the U.S. Senate but defeated in the House. The purpose of that was to make the president and Congress responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment. Wall Street hated the thought of that, and that's why it was defeated. And labor was under severe attack. And labor was supporting that, and then Full Employment Act of 1945 was defeated, and we got the so-called Full Employment Act of 1946, which really had nothing to do with full employment. All it did is set up this council of economic advisors of three so-called wise people that were supposed to know what was happening with the economy, but actually, you know, they couldn't care less what happens to working people. All they care about is Wall Street.
Alan, now, what I was mentioning, part of what you have, and we want to focus on some of the things that you have been speaking of for some time, and you had mentioned a 21st Century Full Employment Act, and I want you to explain, when we talk about full employment, does that mean that everyone in the nation will have a job?
Yeah, everybody that wants to work should have a job. That's what we're saying. That's what's considered full employment. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't have full employment in this country, and full employment with real living wages, I should point out, too. None of these poverty wages. You know, we don't want another CCC program or WPA program where people are paid poverty wages to, we're doing all this work. And these people, you know, were accused of leaning on shovels during the WPA and CCC programs. But for people leaning on shovels, they built sewer systems all over this country. They built roads. They built bridges. They built national parks and state parks and county parks and township parks. They built school buildings. They built huge convention centers. They built city halls and all kinds of, you know, massive projects were built by these guys that supposedly leaned on shovels all day long. So, you know, and they were paid very little. And I think that we need to bring back the WPA and the CCC and the CETA programs, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, to train people to work on the new technologies that would, you know, help to restore our forest and everything else in this country that needs to be done. We need so much needs to be done that simply because we haven't been maintaining our infrastructure for, you know, decades, because everything is being pumped into the war industries. And
right.
This has to end. And unless we end that, and that's why we call this a 21st Century Full Employment Act for peace and prosperity. There is no way we're going to get full employment without achieving peace. And there's no way we're going to have prosperity as long as we're engaged in fighting these dirty imperialist wars all over the world. And Obama attacking people with these drones and everything. It's common sense. If you're investing in this kind of barbaric warfare, you do not have the funds to invest in creating jobs. So in essence, you know, we are killing jobs with every war that we fight. And this has to end. This is something that even the Democratic Congressman, Wright Patman, who wrote and drafted and proposed the 1945 Full Employment Act, he stated that if, you know, if we get going in financing the things that we really need in this country, that will keep us from getting entangled in wars, because we will not have the money to engage in this kind of militarism and these wars. And that makes sense. This is the kind of country most people want. Most people don't want wars. They want our resources to be spent on things that people really need.
Now, we're going to get into a few of the things here in this Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity. I just want to pause just for a second to mention that we have Alan Mackey joining us once again on the Socialist Insight. He joins us every other week and comes in, join our program. He joins our program with a lot of insightful information pertaining to the left and people that believe that socialism is the answer for working people. Alan, just reading just a few of the things in your article, which very impressive. What would be the concept of a 21st Century Full Employment Act and Prosperity? 21st Century Full Employment Act and Prosperity, mandatory full employment, the responsibility of the President and Congress. I don't even think that's even on their agenda right now.
No, it's not on their agenda. But when they run for office, they talk about jobs.
Yeah.
You've probably seen it, just like I have. All these reporters, they'll go to somebody that's running for Congress or even for presidential candidates, and they'll say, what are your three main goals? And they will always say, jobs, jobs, jobs. But when they get elected, they forget
they
about those
say
jobs.
That.
Yeah, always. I don't care what newspaper you pick up. That's always in there when they ask
it's
these
always jobs, jobs,
what they want.
Jobs.
And, you know, as I go across.
Good observation.
As I go across the Great Lakes region here, I've been talking to groups in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and now I'm in Michigan. And people say, yeah, you know, you're making a lot of sense. All these guys talk about is jobs, jobs, jobs when they're running for office, but all we get is unemployment once they're elected. And it makes sense to them. And once they understand that in 1945, a Full Employment Act was brought before the United States Congress and the President, and it was passed by the U.S. Senate, but then defeated by the House and the President, people began to wonder, well, you know, what the heck happened? And what happened during that period was that labor came under severe attack for bringing this program forward. I just recently read a book by Henry A. Wallace, who was Franklin Roosevelt's vice president and secretary of agriculture, and then he ran as a Progressive Party candidate for president. And he wrote a book called 60 Million Jobs. And essentially what he was proposing was a Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity. And when he traveled across the country, what he was talking about became the basis for the 1945 Full Employment Act. And this is, I think, where the progressive movement, the left, has to take up from where it was left off back in 1945, when the Socialist and Communist parties were very strong, when the CIO was very strong, and we had many left-wing-led labor unions in this country, all pushing for this Full Employment Act, and they pushed so hard they got it through the U.S. Senate. We got to take up from there and create a new Full Employment Act. It has to be a 21st Century Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity, because I don't think that back in 1945, Democrats like Wright Patman or even people like Henry Wallace had any idea of how far this military-industrial complex was going to take us into the hole. And, you know, we're now mired in that hole, and we got to find a way to get out of it. And like one state senator here in Minnesota said, David Tomasoni, he said, there's only one way to get out of it. And he called me and said, I agree with you, Alan. We got to work our way out of it. Putting people to work is the only way we're going to get out of this economic mess that we're in. We have to put people to work so people can begin to buy back the things that are being produced, and we can start producing things that are needed by society instead of producing for war. That makes sense to most people. It doesn't make sense to Wall Street, because Wall Street makes, you know, trillions of dollars off of war. These wars create debt. Right now, the U.S. Congress and the president can't agree on what they're going to do about the deficit, and they want to raise the debt ceiling. Why? You know, what are we purchasing that is so important to raise the debt ceiling? We're purchasing wars, barbaric wars, war after war. And that's what they expect us to pay for? We've got to stand
that's
up
the only thing,
no way.
Right. That's the only reason why they want to raise the debt ceiling. They want more money for war. And Wall Street makes money off of wars, and they make money off of cheap labor. You know, those two things. And when they can put millions and millions of people on the unemployment lines, and the ones that are still working, having them to work at poverty wages, they come on ahead of the game. Raise the minimum wage based on cost of living factors indexed to inflation with regular increases to improve standards of living. Now, when you say raise the minimum wage, raise it to what? $20 an hour? $30 an hour? Raise it to what? Because I hear everything from raise it to $9 an hour to some people saying, like Elizabeth Warren, say, well, it should be $22 an hour. And then I have socialists saying, well, it should be like over $35 an hour. Up to what amount do we raise it? Raise that.
Well, it's not really a matter of...
Alan, before you even answer that, I remember back in the 70s when you consider a lot of people that were contractors, many of these people just as union laborers, they were making well over $65 an hour. So when you think of $22 an hour, really $22 an hour doesn't seem like a lot of money. You know, it certainly is not a lot of money when it comes to trying to the cost of living here in California, but What amount are we talking about, Alan?
Okay, well, I don't think it's so much an amount that we're talking about. It's a matter of that the minimum wage has to correspond to the actual cost of living factors. The United States Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, puts all these things together. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren said that $22 an hour would be the minimum wage now if the minimum wage was calculated based on inflation.
Right.
Okay. You know, people like to bait me by saying, you know, well, what do you want the minimum wage to be? And I say it should be a real living wage based on all cost of living factors. Now, I'm in the state of Michigan right now. If we look at all the cost of living factors as calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and we pay these people $90,000 to $120,000 to $140,000 a year to figure all these things out and just track these figures. Alan Greenspan, you know, pointed out that we pay these people that much money. And if we base it on cost of living, like here in the state of Michigan, the minimum wage should be somewhere between $24 and $26 an hour. People say, whoa, how can any businessman afford to pay people that? Well, the fact of the matter is, anybody that looks at the Wall Street Journal or any business publication, you can see all these proceeds going into Wall Street's pockets in the form of all kinds of stock dividends and, you know, on bonding proposals or getting all this interest. Well, it's a matter of we have to take what working people have produced, and all this, when we talk about wealth, all wealth is produced by labor. So, you know, we're not talking about taking something from somebody that they're not entitled to. We're talking about redistributing wealth back to the people who have produced that wealth. And,
right.
You know, there's no any banker, if you told the president of a major bank, you know, we're not going to pay you $30 an hour for what you do, he would look at you and say, ha ha, I get a lot more than that. Well, you know, nobody's, you know, he's not producing anything. And
right.
Working people are producing the wealth of this country. What's the problem with paying people what they're entitled to get? And if it's $24, $26 an hour, or $30 or $35 an hour, if that's what working people are entitled to based on what they produce and the cost of living, then what's the problem? You know, I don't see where there should be any problem. Nobody from Wall Street, none of these executives that caused the problems that we're having today, and they caused these problems, not working people. These people were paying, they were paid big, big money. You know, we're not talking about $30 an hour. We're talking about they were paid thousands of dollars an hour to get us into this economic mess that we're in, and they don't want to pay working people, you know, $24, $26 an hour. This makes absolutely no sense at all once we start talking in these terms. But the problem is the mainstream media doesn't want us talking in these terms of that labor produces all wealth. They don't want to hear that.
Alan, I see even where I work at, I work in the automobile industry, and they have people applying for jobs as receptionists and lot service porters where they get vehicles ready after a person purchases a car. And depending on whether it's a receptionist or a porter, they're paying these people, they're offering them jobs anywhere from $8.50 an hour to $9 an hour. And it's okay as far as doing the interview. They show up for the interview, fill out the application and everything until they find out how much the job is paying. And then when they call back and say, you know, they want the person to start work, they have to leave one message after another, and the people not even returning the calls. They're not returning the calls because after they find out that they're going to be working for like $8.50 or $9 an hour, they don't have time for it. Especially the ones that don't return the calls when they find out that it's only going to be for 25 to 30 hours a week.
Right. And that's what it's coming down to, because with Obamacare especially, all these companies are trying to figure out how to get out from under the little bit that Obamacare requires them to pay, and they're finding that they have to have huge part-time labor forces now in this country to get out from under Obamacare. So that's one way that Obamacare has had a very negative impact on our entire society already. All these companies are hiring all these people to advise them, and these people that talk about, you know, we can't pay working people $24, $26 an hour, well, they're charging these corporations thousands of dollars an hour to tell them how to evade paying health care in this country now, you know. So, you know, one thing, you know, people say, oh, $24, $26 an hour, that's a lot of money to pay somebody for doing a job like flipping hamburgers or something. But if we had a national public health care system, if we had a national public child care system where people were getting all these things that they're really entitled to as a human right for free, then that would be taken into consideration when we consider setting the minimum wage, because those would be very big cost of living factors that you wouldn't have to consider. So the more we institute these huge universal social programs, which also create jobs, the lower the minimum wage can fall. That should make, you know, big business happy. It doesn't, though, but it should. And this is the only way that the minimum wage should be lowered. If you're a working person, if $5 an hour is the minimum wage, if you can buy everything you need from health care to education to riding the bus to paying for a car to paying for a rent or a mortgage, if you can do that at $5 an hour, I don't care if I get $5 an hour. Do you? You know?
No.
And if it can be done for $2 an hour, that's fine, too, if that's what the cost of living is.
Yeah, that's fine, too. But then
that's not where our cost of living is at.
Where's the limit? because, you know, I was listening to Forbes one day on Fox, and he was mentioning, he said, well, if I can get workers to work for a dollar an hour, you know, I'm going to do it, you know. And
exactly.
I mean, yeah, so you're wondering, where's the limit?
Well, the limit should be cost of living.
Cost of living
should be the limit. That should be our limit.
And that makes all the sense. People should be able to afford to make a living based on what their income. They shouldn't be, after they have worked 40 hours or 30 hours a week, you know, trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet.
Exactly. And Alan, anybody that works 40 hours an hour should be able to make ends meet. You know, that's something so basic. I mean, we're talking basic human decency and human justice when we're talking about working 40 hours a week. People should be able to cover the cost of their living, you know, and actually a little more. But even
right.
if, you know, most people would be very satisfied to cover just their cost of living. Most people cannot do that in this country right now.
Alan, I'm looking at the jobs program. Healthcare, 15 million jobs.
Right.
Talk to me about 15 million jobs.
Well, the way 15 million jobs would be created, like we have public schools in every neighborhood and community, well, we would, instead of 800 military bases spread out all over the world, we would have neighborhood and community health care centers where people could just walk in and get the health care that they need. This takes place in a number of countries around the world right now, places like Finland, Cuba, you know, the other Scandinavian countries, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be, that shouldn't be the basis of healthcare right in, here in the United States. This is the richest country in the world. There's no reason we shouldn't have a world-class healthcare system that people around the world could look to as an example instead of this for-profit healthcare system where we have people working at poverty wages in hospitals and doctor's offices and everything else. We should have people working at real living wages, serving in community and neighborhood healthcare centers, providing people with whatever healthcare they need when they need it, and they shouldn't be charged a single penny. This could be done for much less than what these wars are costing us. That's so basic. And when we consider that, we put these two things next to each other, I think most Americans would agree they would choose health care over wars. And, you know, the priorities in this country are so screwed up, it's unbelievable.
Now, I'm looking here, you say child care. Now, just recently I was talking to husband and wife, and the wife just said, even though she had a college degree, which she still had to pay for her education, she was mentioning that she just preferred not to work because the child care for her two kids, her two children, was going to be costing her $1,300 a month. That was just for child care. And you say child care is going to create 5 million jobs. Talk to us about that.
Well, if we have neighborhood child care centers, what we would essentially be talking about doing is having child care centers attached or close to the neighborhood schools, and people could drop their kids off at these child care centers on their way to work and pick them up, and there would be no cost to them. Again, you know, if you eliminate the profit motive, all these things can be done very easily, and child care is one of those things. Child care is a human right. The United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognizes child care as a basic and fundamental human right, just like it recognizes the right to a job as a basic and fundamental human right. This is all being avoided and evaded by the politicians in this country. Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the main architects of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where all these things were put into it. And nobody wants to talk about these things in the mainstream media right now. Because, you know, we can't pay for these things as long as we're paying for these wars. The alternative would be to tax the wealthy. I mean, we'd have to tax the hell out of the wealthy to pay for these programs. And there's probably less political will to do that than there is to end these wars and to use those peace dividends to create these programs. We got to look at putting people to work, providing society and people with the things that they need instead of putting people to work. You know, all these politicians talk about private industry putting people to work. Well, private industry isn't going to put 23 million people to work in this country. Private industry is responsible for at least 23 million people being unemployed right now. Private industry and the so-called free market economy, the capitalist economy, are responsible for this unemployment. We can't expect them to fix it. We couldn't expect them to fix it in the 1930s, and we certainly can't expect them to fix it now. It's got to be massive government programs providing people with things that they need and things that society needs that puts people to work at real living wages that is going to solve the problems. We have to work our way out of this situation, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Now, Alan, I see a real big one that we see across the nation now. It's the infrastructure, and when we think about the infrastructure of a city and how much work is involved, and many of these cities are just teetering on the brink of bankruptcy because, again, we're using these funds to finance wars rather than to take care of the infrastructure and our community needs. But when I look at this city such as New York and Los Angeles, I ran as a candidate for mayor of Los Angeles, and we were talking about many of the problems they had with the infrastructure back in 1989 when I ran as a candidate. But here, some of the sewage systems and water systems and where they need to upgrade the utility systems within the city, those systems, Alan, are 60 to like 80 years old. And they still, now as it's at a point, they're waiting for catastrophic breakdowns before anything is done. But, Alan, that one is one that needs immediate attention, and it can create millions of jobs. But you say WPA, Infrastructure, Schools, Community Centers. Speak to us a little bit about that.
Well, the Works Progress Administration, workers built under that program, under Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration, which was put in place by a guy named Harry Hopkins, who developed the WPA and the CCC programs and was advocating many other government programs to put people to work. You know, these workers, they built the sewer systems. I've been right here in the city of Grand Rapids, where I am right now, Grand Rapids, Michigan. There's a little community where the houses were literally bulldozed over because the sewer systems couldn't handle the runoff water and the houses were flooded. So FEMA paid these people off for their houses and bulldozed the houses over, and now there's vacant land sitting there. And I found out that this is going on in many communities across the country. The sewer systems are filled with roots and everything else, and they haven't been properly cleaned. They're falling apart, and the sewer systems weren't built back in those days to handle the kind of housing that we have in the populations that we have today. So these sewer systems haven't been upgraded, so entire communities are essentially being flooded whenever it rains. And, you know, we hit projects like this that, you know, we could put people to work on doing. In Minnesota, where I live, we had a huge bridge collapse, killing many people and injuring others. And, you know, that bridge had to be rebuilt because it was built under the for-profit motive. Millions of dollars were wasted. We have the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin are projecting building a bridge across the St. Croix River, a bridge that's going to cost over $1
billion.
You know, over $1 billion. And the contractors, the construction companies, and the architects are going to take most of that money before it even goes in the construction of the bridge even begins. So, you know, these could all be done under a WPA, Works Progress Administration program, and it could probably be done for close to half of what they're projecting the cost to be. And, you know, when you consider that, then you can go and take that money and build another bridge where it's needed. If they have the money to put $1 billion into a bridge, why don't they have the resources and the wherewithal and the willpower to do it under a public works project like what was done during the 1930s? These bridges and buildings have lasted for years. Many of them that they're knocking over right now, you know, the wrecking crews are saying they're almost impossible to knock down because they were built so solidly. And, you know, we have schools and everything that have lasted for decades and all built under a public works jobs program that the intent was to put people to work because they were unemployed. We could be doing the same thing right now, and we should be doing that right now. The CCC program, the Civilian Conservation Corps program, reforested literally hundreds of thousands of acres in this country after the logging and timber companies came through and clear-cut everything. And we have the same thing that it developed today. The logging industry has clear-cut so much land that we don't know where we're going to get our lumber from in the decades to come. And a CCC program could reforest all of that. You know, we're not the politicians that are in power aren't thinking properly, and we need a new kind of politician, a working-class politician that understands the problems from this viewpoint, that are going to put people before profit if we're going to begin to solve these problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alan, I know that you put the CEDAR training program. I remember back in the I remember back in the 70s and in the 80s, especially in the aerospace industry, where the CEDAR program put thousands, tens of thousands of people to work, those training programs. And now those programs have just vanished, and they're charging people tens of thousands. Right now, the student loan debt is over $1.2 trillion in this country. They are training people for profit, but they're not creating jobs. But speak a little bit about the CEDAR program and how that could be used as a means of creating employment here in this country.
Well, the CEDAR program trained people for all kinds of public works programs. It even trained a lot of people for private industry.
For private.
But one, you know, and I've got no objection to that. I think that a good Comprehensive Employment and Training Act is needed right now. In fact, you know, we should say it wasn't even a Democrat that brought forward CEDAR. It was Nixon, a Republican, that brought forward the CEDAR program, which was a very good program based on the New Deal programs. And they were training people for the new technologies. A lot of the people that are now working on computers, they got their basic training through the CEDAR programs. And these are people that are working in private and public industry today. And if it weren't for CEDAR, we wouldn't have even had people that were competent to work in the computer era, in the digital age. You know, we could look at training people for under the CEDAR program to create a national program like Habitat for Humanity. You know, think about it. Why do we have homeless people in the richest country in the world? You know, this is a crime against humanity in itself. And a CEDAR program could be training homeless people to build their own homes. You know, that's just plain common sense and logic. And there are a lot of people that are willing to do that by, and we can see that by how popular the Habitat for Humanity program is. It's a very limited program right now, but if the government were to undertake a program like that, you know, there would be no homeless people in this country.
Alan, you say retirement, 55. I believe it should be 50. But is that possible where we could be looking at where the government could create a situation where people could retire at 55? Because right now see Washington, D.C., they're trying to get it higher and higher. They are already starting to look at 75.
Exactly. And that's the same way with every single program, though, because we got a government that's run by Wall Street. Everything is done against the working people and the working class rather than the benefit working people and the working class. Reducing the retirement age to 55 would create millions of new jobs. Reducing it to 50, which could probably be done too, would create millions and millions of more new jobs, you know, putting younger people to work and allowing people to live a decent life in their retirement. And, you know, This also, the right to a decent retirement is also a guaranteed basic human right under the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it only makes sense to let people retire at an earlier age when you've got the massive unemployment that we do in this country right now. Common sense.
Three weeks minimum vacation time for everyone with pay.
Well, that too, people say that's far-fetched, but it's not. In the Scandinavian countries, most people get more vacation time than that. And
right
here in the richest country in the world, we could do it too. It only takes the political will to do that. And, you know, this is the way we got to begin to look at work, that people are not just here. They haven't just been put here to provide unlimited work day in and day out for these corporate bosses. you know, at these corporate bosses, you know, what do they do? If you look at their lifestyle, you know, they have a very easy life to start with, but they go out on their yachts, they go out on the golf courses and go out to the country clubs, you know. They live a life, a pretty leisurely life, and they're living that leisurely life off of what labor produces. So why aren't working people allowed some leisure in their lives too, since they're the ones that are producing the wealth of this country?
Now, Alan, I'm going to get into a couple of things. You say pay for it all. Peace dividends derived from ending militarism and wars. You've already mentioned that. Hefty tax on the rich. Now, one of the things I find is a lot of times even people on the left, when I say, well, we need to tax the rich. And right away, you know, I run in opposition, maybe because they don't understand how rich people have been getting a tax break for, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, it's always been, that's the way capitalism worked. But explain how you're going to be able to derive all of this. We know a big chunk of it, Alan, is from ending the wars, militarism.
Right.
You say hefty tax on rich. How else are you going to pay for this?
Okay, first of all, a number of economists are saying that there is going to be no peace dividends, that the wars are costing us so much that we'll be paying for them forever, and there will be no peace dividends. Well, if that is the case, then we got to look and say, hey, these Wall Street people have made all this money, their profits have been derived from wars, and it's time to levy a huge and hefty tax on these rich people that have profited from wars and militarism. And there's no two ways about it. We either got to get a huge peace dividends from ending these wars, or we got to tax the rich. And I think we're going to probably have to do both. We're going to have a huge tax on Wall Street transactions. We're going to have to probably double the employer portions of the Social Security tax. We're going to have to think in terms of taxing the mining companies on the basis of the tonnage that they extract from the land. We're going to have to start looking at stumpage fees for the forestry industry. We're going to start having to look at fees on the oil and gas industry. You know, all this oil, they're talking about all these pipelines. Well, the oil and the gas flowing through these pipelines should be taxed, and it should be taxed to the hilt based on the profits. So, you know, we got to start looking at all these ways to begin to raise money. And the bottom line is, I think we need a federal publicly owned bank like the State Bank of North Dakota. We need a national public bank, and we need state public banks all across this country in order to handle the funds, so we're not paying the bankers huge handling fees and interest rates on what we need to do. And this is all possible. It's been done in other countries. And the State Bank of North Dakota works very fine in North Dakota. There's no reason why it can't work fine all over this country.
Alan, I'm going to speak with you a little bit about a guaranteed basic income. But what I want to ask is, you know, Washington, D.C., the Democrats and the Republicans, the two corporate parties, they belong to Wall Street. I mean, how are we going to get Washington to do all of this, to get these elected representatives to do this? And they're working for the executives on Wall Street to install them in their positions. How is this going to happen?
Well, I think we got to get out of
our heads. Are we just dreaming?
I think we got to get it out of our heads that we can convince these people that are in power in Washington right now that they're going to do what's right. I don't think that, no matter how big the movement, I don't think they're going to do what's right. I think they would rather beat us over the head with clubs and shoot us down in the streets than do what's right. I think we have to look at electing real people's politicians, people like yourself who have been running for office, and, you know, we're going to have to start looking at a whole new way at our legislatures and even the town halls and city councils. We need people in there. We need working people in those offices that understand what's taking place in this country, that Wall Street is our enemy, that Wall Street has to be challenged for political and economic power. You know, we're not just talking about political power. We're talking about economic power. And it's Wall Street. We have to see Wall Street as our enemy, and that's their enemy that we need to defeat, and we need to elect people to public office that are going to challenge Wall Street for this political and economic power. I don't see any other way to do it.
Alan, I want you to, because I don't believe much of this is possible without us having a guaranteed basic income. I believe that that's, you know, you mentioned about Nixon years ago and some of the programs he instituted back in the late 60s. But when you think about Nixon, he was one that was talking about a guaranteed basic income. I didn't even know what a guaranteed basic income was in 1970 until I started hearing a Republican president talk about that. And all of a sudden I said, well, what is a guaranteed basic income? And surprisingly, I had another Republican in 1970 in the military tell me, well, this is what a guaranteed basic income is. And he was saying that he thought it was good because he had the president of the United States was a proponent of it. But what socialists are always talking about, many socialist parties and organizations are talking about a guaranteed basic income. What is that, and do you support that?
Well, I do support it, but I also think that there's a somewhat of a drawback, and that is that unless we think in terms of creating jobs, we're not going to really solve the problems. But I think we do have to say if people aren't going to get jobs, then they do need, they're entitled to a basic living income. And there's no two ways about that. You can't just leave people without jobs and then leave them without income. Only, politicians who don't have any compassion or concern for the human condition would say that we shouldn't have a basic living income for everybody. You know, and if a government can't provide people with jobs, then they're going to have to provide people with a living income. I know I had this discussion with Cindy Sheehan about 2 months ago, and she says one thing you've left off is a living income. And I think that that's going to have to be included on here. We've got to begin to talk about that, and it's got to be put in front of people. If people aren't going to get jobs at real living wages, then the government is going to have to provide them with a living income. Or, you know, where people are getting poverty wages, then the government is going to have to make that up and provide, compensate them to the point where they do get a living income. If people want to subsidize, essentially what it would be doing is subsidizing the profits of the corporations. It would be letting them off the hook for paying living wages. But, you know, if we have to do that, then we have to do that. Because this is, we're talking about the human condition and people's right to a decent standard of living and a livelihood that's in line with what this country being the world's richest country in the world. And, you know, how do we evade that? I don't think we can when we're paying for wars. I'd rather pay somebody to sit on their couch at home watching television than to pay somebody to go out and kill people in a war.
Right.
And, you know, so that's the way I look at it. That's what I told Cindy Sheehan. And I think we got to begin to bring this out into the public square in just that way, you know, that, yeah, let's pay somebody to sit at home and watch television or do their art or whatever instead of paying them to go fight wars. If that makes more sense. If we can afford people to go fight a war, we can afford to pay somebody to sit at home and watch television, and at least nobody is dying as a result.
Alan, last thing I want to just speak about, what is the new Progressive Alliance? We have around another 4 minutes here. What is the new Progressive Alliance, what is on their agenda for preparing for the 2016 election? Because you see the Democrats and the Republicans, they are already getting in gear, and we don't need any more of the sick leadership that has been produced by the Democrats and Republicans. At least we need to have a voice out there in 2016, and that voice needs to start, and people need to start hearing that voice now, from whether it's four or five individuals or whether it's 10 individuals. But what is the new Progressive Alliance doing as far as looking for potential leadership for 2016 now until then?
Right now we're trying to get our unified progressive platform that's based on people, peace, and the planet first before a lot of these candidates that are running. And what we're doing is asking these candidates what their position is, and we'll support them if they support our 10-point program, which peace is at the top of the list, full employment at a living wage second, saving the environment third, a real social safety net, which would include what you were talking about, a real living income for people, five, Medicare for all, 6, fair trade, not free trade, but fair trade, where the United States would engage in trade with other countries, not to exploit the people in other countries or to rob them of their natural resources, but to exchange on the basis of what is fair. 7 is we want to advance human rights and civil liberties rather than curtail human rights and civil liberties. And we're asking candidates to state their position on these issues. We think real election reform is needed, and that's the we got to find a way to get big money out of politics. And I don't think we can say we're not going to engage in electoral activity unless big money is out of politics. But we got to say we're for limiting and restricting the amount of money that can be spent on these political campaigns, because it costs millions of dollars right now to get elected to Congress in any congressional district in this country. The losers are spending, $4, $5, $6 million in a lot of these congressional races, and even more. Number 9, there has to be a corporate accountability and a reform. And number 10, infrastructure investment and ownership, which we were talking about, where, we need to invest in public works projects. We need to restore or rebuild our infrastructure in this country and build new schools, build new sewer systems, new water systems across this country. There's so much to do, and we're asking the candidates to take a position on these 10 points, and if they support our 10 points, we'll support them in running for public office. If they don't support them, we're going to advise people not to vote for these people.
And Alan, once again, I want to tell you we appreciate you joining the program. Alan, how can our listeners be able to get more information on this 21st Century Jobs program?
Well, they can call me at right now. They can get me on my cell phone, 651-587-5541. They can leave a message at my home number while I'm on the road at 218-386-2432. They can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my blog with all my email contact information and everything else on there.
And I just want to let our listeners know that we're in some pretty critical times in this country. The government in Washington is not on our side. The leadership in Washington is not on our side. So we must unite, and we must unite behind programs such as what Alan Mackey has been sharing with us today. Alan, once again, thanks for joining the program, and we look forward to having you back on in 2 weeks. Thanks again for listening, and thanks for joining the Socialist Insight. Have a good night, everyone.
Thanks again, Alan. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Yep, thanks for having me, Stuart.